All righty, it's time for us to begin. If everyone could find a reasonable spot, we'll be getting settled into our study in Leviticus chapter 19 in just a moment. Before we do so, if you would bow your heads together in prayer with me. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the privilege that it is to draw near to your throne and to your grace and mercy. We hope that the light that is you is able to illuminate within us the things that reflect your glory. Help us to be servants. Help us to be understanding and compassionate. Help us to be wise in the troubles that this life brings. Please help us to learn to be holy in the midst of an unholy world and grow our faith well. We pray this in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so in this section of the text of Leviticus is that shift from, in some ways, the corporate or the together worship of Israel and moves into day-to-day living or application of spiritual matters in day-to-day matters, things that would be common for an Israelite in this time frame under the covenant to need to know. You'll find in all of these sections a reminder or instructions that are connected to very specific key historical events in the journey of Israel, where they're dealing with problems they've already encountered, and God is now instructing them under the law how to handle those problems, those spiritual calamities, those brokenness issues that come up. It's really important to kind of connect that on a practical level, at least for me, in this way. We don't necessarily see, if you will, a good insight into the standards of God until the law. They're there, and we kind of coagulate them together or clump them together under do what God said. You know, that's the general tenor of everything from the garden through the patriarchs to Moses. We kind of just kind of clump that as one thing. But we don't always see detail of, well, okay, what is he expecting of them on a day-to-day basis? What is he expecting of them in their when they go offer sacrifices? And they do. The patriarchs do. And when they engage in worship to God, we don't see a lot of that. We do see God accepting it. We do at times see God rejecting it. We move into the law. A lot of those mysteries, because they're not revealed to us, are opened up. God defines, he describes, he specifies, he helps clarify. And a powerful reason for that is really simple. It's no longer branching through a patriarch who has a day-to-day potential connection to God. We can go and ask God, hey, tell me this thing. Tell me about this. And God says, do this. When you move into the relationship of the covenant, Israel has a different kind of connection with Jehovah. It's one that does still allow for that individual immediate pillar, if you will, to go back to God. But there's an umbrella law that they're all now attached to. And that law is uniform to everybody. It's the same standards, the same expectations. They're going to be the same people and developing in the same general ways. So now you see all that really kind of laid out. It's kind of interesting to see it from that level to see, okay, why is he doing these things? And they tie back to, like we saw on Wednesday night, specific historical challenges that were common on a day-to-day basis for Israel. Things like interaction with their family members, marital questions, how they interact with foreigners through their land. All of those things were going to be stuff that was historical, but also immediate and practical. And did you have something? Yeah. Well, and it's all under the covenant. This is all focused on the covenantal relationship, and it would focus primarily on the Jewish side of things or the proselyte side of things. Those two groups would now fall under the umbrella connection banner, if you will. Right. Yeah, and even in chapter 19, we're going to look at some of the things that are powerful on the way in which they maintain the land. Not just the don't interbreed your species of livestock, which was a standard. But you think about, and we'll kind of jump ahead here to catch this illustration. When they're planting their fields, first expectation is to not mix the seed, right? On a practical level, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you don't want to have to harvest two types of crop at the same time. But there was another one. When they were coming in to gather from the field, they would do what with the property and the land? What was the broader expectation of that practice? Right. There was a cycle that was going to be brought in. It led eventually to the understanding of the Jubilee section as well, which is a reclamation of ancestral land in that sense, and they kind of returned to its original owners. But they left that glean strip on the outside. And by the way, one time you have the Pharisees in the first century, they had a measurement and a standard for that glean strip. That they had to be this size, no bigger, no smaller, which is very much how they worked and how they moved. But they also said, don't pick up your droppings. Like if you're gathering and you drop something, don't pick that up. The primary reason that is tied together a bit to this picture of a holy place, it's a special place, was a heart for the poor. You leave it because God said, but then He says why He told you. You know, sometimes we don't always know why God says do it this way. This one it says, boom, we know. So that those who are poor, who will be among you, can go into that land and they can have what they need. Remember, who is their poor? Primary poor in Israel. Wait for it. Them. Their families. Their blood kin. People of Israel. But also, like Tamar pointed out, they had people traveling through at times. The foreigner would come through. And he doesn't delineate and say the foreigners can't have that food. The Pharisees did, too. As if you read through their writings, they were very particular about everything. But that helps us understand the heart behind a holy choice. Because this is a demonstration of God's heart in this understanding of the law. He made a choice for holiness, keep them separate, allow the space, but there's always a bigger picture there. There's a bigger picture of His understanding and His perspective. Because one of the things we've highlighted, this goes back to Leviticus chapter 11, verses 44 and 45, that the general premise of Leviticus is really how to understand holiness as it relates to God's holiness, and this sense of holiness there is allowing now Israel to get closer to God as a people than they had before. Rather than that patriarchal tree section that kind of vanishes, now you have a structured one. But Israel can get a lot closer to Jehovah when they're holy and when they're not. So beginning in our text, you have that refrain. This is, we've tied it together already a couple different ways. You have the statement, chapter 19, verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all the congregation of the people of Israel, and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. That's one of those big, powerful refrains from Leviticus that we say, I'm going to remember that because it's really important. But it repeats itself. It repeats itself. And this is still immediately following the awful circumstances of an offering made to the Lord and then a improper offering made to the Lord and Israel seeing the bodies of the rebellious hearts leave the camp. And they see the consequence of an unholy act in the presence of a holy God. That's reinforcing this idea of spiritual holiness. And then with that statement, the next phrase, and this is verse 3, every one of you shall revere his mother and his father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. If I ask you what the connection is between the Sabbath and your mom and dad, how hard would it be to answer that question? The answer is, it depends on which side of the cube you look at. Okay, so why does God talk about His Sabbaths? It's plural in the text right there. So you've got the concept of a rest, right? That's what the Sabbath initially involved in. And so you think about the initial, if you will, introduction or application of a Sabbath is that rest side. But God here is talking about on a holy level. There's a holiness component. The connection here isn't some level of esoteric or unknown detail about mom and dad that connects to the Sabbath. It's about equivalency. It's understanding that in the perspective of God, things that you may not necessarily equate as being the same value. The first connection here is that God actually values those in the same realm. Another translation where it says revere in the ESV, it will say fear mother and father. And I think that's the ASV in the original King James might use the fear terminology there. When you have the term revere and fear together, that gives you two edges of a Hebrew idiom or a phrase that kind of means both and a little bit more. One of those stretchy Hebrew terms that isn't just literally fear as we would use it. And it's more about respect, which is another way the same words get translated. You ever fear your mom and dad? For real? Yeah. Yes. You know, and when the right hand for my father went right about here, you know, that's when I knew that the fear button had to turn on. And for my mom, it was when her left hand went to the spoon. Those were the two different ways in which discipline was certainly applied in my house. But revere and respect is a shifty thing. Especially as you mature and you recognize how dumb you are and how smart your parents were. You know, that kind of balancing takes place. Now you put it in context of this comparison. God is saying that to revere, to respect, to keep in reverence your parents is equivalent to the power of keeping the Sabbath. These are equal things. Now make one more leap of conversation to the time in which Christ is here. To the typical Israelite of the first century, not the Pharisee, not the Sadducee, but the typical Israelite, they generally understood the concept of a holy Sabbath. They didn't have the nuanced, detailed, nitpicky understanding of the scribes and the lawyers. But they didn't have the I don't care attitude of the spiritually destitute. They kept it holy. And they generally understood that mom and dad were given to them by God, and they generally understood that that was a good thing. But when Jesus dealt with this edge over here with the Pharisees and the Sadducees, He mocked them for their dismissal of their parents. You know, your parents have a need, and you say, no, I've given that to God, you can't have it. Think for a moment. Were they actually saying that God was going to get that money? No. They were saying, no, Mom, Dad, you can't have it right now because I'm saving it for God in my pocket. Is actually what was going down. So, but the Pharisee, Sabbath was a big deal. That's when they went out with their enforcement groups and basically snapped down on folks who weren't keeping the Sabbath properly. It created problems in the history of Israel in that time frame. That's why you have Maccabees. And that's the whole reason for them is improper activities under the side of the law. So now when God, back here in Leviticus, makes revering your mother and father equivalent to the Sabbath, He says these are things that help you make an understanding of holiness. That helps it broaden our perspective of the idea. Because remember what the last step of that in the expectation of Christ? The weightier matters. When Jesus talks about the weightier matters, what were the weightier matters? The things they left undone, grace, mercy, forgiveness. Are those weightier matters as sometimes when we try to figure out things? They can be, especially when you say, how does it affect my heart? Which hangs on my heart with more pressure. The mechanical aspects of keeping the Sabbath or being in a position where someone won't forgive me. Because you tend to take the scales on the other end. How broken are you when you know that someone won't say, I forgive you? You feel kind of trapped, right? You're like basically smushed to the ground. That's a powerful point here, again, when we step back and think about what is God saying is important. Well, of equivalency in the realms of holiness, the Sabbath, your relationship to mom and dad, and then as you step through the text, you're going to see a lot more in these basic illustrations and applications that really kind of pull, again, on our heart there too. Tim? And a couple caveats or perspectives to that. Remember, God has chosen as part of His means of instruction to use imperfect people to teach about a perfect God. Parents are imperfect. That bubble wasn't burst for you at some point on your own doing. It's now burst for you now. Parents are not perfect. Mom and Dad didn't make every decision perfectly. They knew it and they apologized. Eventually it came out. But He uses that. Further, many of us did not necessarily have the best parental guidance when we were growing up. When it comes to spiritual things, I can tell you how much I got. Go get in jail. That was pretty much the extent of that. If you stay out of jail, you're good. Yes, they gave more, but not really of substantial things. We never read the Bible in my house. So, you're not going to get a lot if you're not actually trying to. God is still working with all of those things and trying to help us grasp and understand that this is a valuable aspect of what holiness can be gleaned from. Further in Proverbs, and this is a great parallel to it, to kind of see an inspired application of the principle. Solomon writes, this is Proverbs 30, verse 17, "The eye that mocketh at his father and despiseth..." What happens when I try to use the King James? I struggle. "Despiseth to obey his mother, the ravens of the valley shall pick it out, and the young eagles shall eat it." Key point about the Proverbs, it's not really about the physical eye. This is wisdom literature. It's a little bit deeper than the surface of the waters. It's about the thing that the eye there represents, the heart. And so when your heart is despising and disobeying, this is the fuller consequence of in a spiritual level. It demonstrates a bit of a rottenness in the core of a person that has come about. And there are areas where we can grow and go beyond it in the long run. So, again, you have that mixture of holiness. Holiness in the home, if you will. Holiness on the Sabbaths. Verse 4, and actually, I'm probably starting having folks read because my voice is getting through the fall season of the second layer of allergies. So if I see you with the Bible open, you better be open to Leviticus 19 because I might call on you. And speaking of which, Mike, could you read verse 4 for us? Yeah. All right, so is this like a big surprise moment? Should Israel maybe take some gold and make a golden goat? Is that something that... Because they already made a calf, that didn't work out. Golden goat, not a good idea either. But here's a particular application of it on the idolatry side. And it's the beginning of an introduction of the Decalogue, of the Ten Commandments in that sense. But really on a practical level, we understand something broader than the idea of physical idolatry. Make a calf, bow down to it. Cut up a tree, bow down to half of it that's been carved into an idol, and you keep yourself warm with the other half. We understand that level of idolatry. The Bible, though, takes this term, idolatry, and this part of the law, idolatry, and then the spokesman of God in the Old Testament, and the apostles, and the inspired men of the New Testament, and they branch out, and they tell us idolatry is more than that. Why would idolatry be more than that? More than just the specifics of don't do the metal God thing. Yeah, the reason why, and that's Romans chapter 1. Yeah. It highlights, again, the consequences of that reason why. You know, we have, why would someone make an image of themselves and bow down to it? Well, they've elevated themselves. And that creates symptoms. Symptoms of, does God matter anymore if you make your own gods? Well, He does, but you can act like He doesn't. And if you make your own God, who gets to write the standard? I do. I get to decide what's holy and unholy and what's right and unright. And that precipitates and predicts some new challenges. Because you're going to have people around you who are still trying to be holy as God is holy. So you're going to have another layer of new challenges. And that's the Israelites of the first century. Their world was very crossed over. All the streams of idolatry ran right through Jerusalem and all around it. You know, especially in the environs around Jerusalem, all the communities above and below had basically turned as pagan as possible for the most part. You know, you had a lot of Roman settlements. You had other nations that were moved in by the Roman Empire and other empires. And so it was no longer the Israel of old at all in those outer reaches. So again, you have that application. So idolatry can be applied to attitudes of the heart. It can be applied to the way in which you view physical things. You can be idolatrous about a relationship even. You could make your relationship maybe with your wife and elevate that so high up that God becomes second to it as well. And the New Testament and the Old Testament would often illustrate that in various, very specific and clear ways. This is also a stamp of approval to a certain degree that appears on a regular basis in this section of Leviticus, where it will say, I am the Lord your God, or some translations will say, I am Jehovah your God. And that's the same Hebrew word that's a little bit, it's that four-letter Hebrew phrase, you may have seen it before in Bible studies, that we're not quite sure what the missing letters are. But it's a stamp of approval. It's like the signet seal of God has been stamped down on that sentence. I want you to know, I need you to know, that this is God saying it, not me. So a great parallel, if you want to kind of highlight it together, is with Paul. In Paul's writing, does he ever make a distinction between what he says and what God himself says? Yeah, he does. Does he use the same terminology? No. He says, not I, but the Lord. And so Paul's stamp is transitional. Well, that's because Paul usually likes to use a lot of words. God had him write really long letters with really complex sentences. That's just what he does. So you have that stamp of, okay, but I know, right here. And we also look at Colossians, and we make an application of that principle there. And what does it say in Colossians in regards to whether we should do something? I'm going to start the memory verse. I know you know it. Whatever we do. Yeah, we all know it. But think about the application right here. They now know. Because by inspiration, Moses reminds them and reminds us, I am the Lord. I'm Jehovah. As he's speaking in that role. And that's a powerful reminder here. That really clarifies something simple on the first reading, but as we've kind of noted, it becomes much more rich and much more complex when we stretch it out. All right, verses 5 through 8. Let's see. Roy, you look ready. So you get volunteered. Thank you.
And the problem remains.
All right, so broadly, peace offerings have been discussed back in chapter 3 and chapter 7. This one would have fit into a classification of a type of burnt offering, and parts of it were eaten in that process. It's interesting to note, in this bigger category of things that are holy and unholy, he gives a cap. Do we do that already in life about foodstuffs? Do we have like, how old can this be? Anyone ever take milk to you and say, does it smell bad? My answer is always, look, if you're asking me, it's going to be yes. Because if you can't decide, I'm not tasting it, you know. But spiritually, that breakdown is not about the quality of its healthiness. That's not on the table here. It's not even a question in the context of, is this going to be physically good or bad for you? So that's shifted off the table to the side. Further, we're talking about individual activity for the most part here. These are things about a day-to-day Israelite's connection to God, and they're offering a peace offering, and they're going to have a part of that. And it says there's a timeliness to it. Now, if you set aside the practicalities of do it in this time frame, what are the spiritual ramifications of leaving an offering undone? Isn't that something that Jesus talks a little bit about in his work on in the New Testament, about you go to the temple and you remember something? What are you supposed to do? Go fix it. Go apologize. Go make it right. Go make amends with your brother. Go straighten things out. Real simple, practical side of things that way. But he says, go make it right. Don't go to the temple. But now remember, wait a minute, there's a capstone on it. We're learning about that here, that there's a certain amount of time to accomplish that task. You ever tried to do that and it kind of got distracted? Like, you remember, like, I do this. This is a normal thing for me. I got to do something. And so I forget, when I remember to do that, to write it down on my note list of things to do, a secret list that only Jill has access to. And this is what I have to do. And I forgot to do that. How likely is it that I'll remember to do it? I forgot to do it the first time. I barely remembered the second time, but I didn't write it down. So I probably won't follow through. You understand that we sometimes do that with spiritual things that are really important, that we need to make something right, and the spear of Acts chapter 2 gets deep enough to finally pierce through the scars of our life, and it hurts. We go, what do I need to do? And we get motivated to go do something, and maybe, you know, we're about to dial the number to say, hey, can we have coffee? And then something happens, and we have to go do that, and it's really important. We get sidetracked. Having that cap on it isn't just about the practical boundary that says that I'll get it done by this many number of days. It's to help understand that there's value there. That actually it is a priority. That relationship that's broken, that the peace offering is part of, make peace with God, make peace with man, is so important that it becomes super high priority. But I'm sure, like you and me, we are balancing priorities in life. I think you and I do that often. We all, you know, okay, well, I've got this is really important, and this is really important, and this is really important, and we're trying to pick one, and okay, this is the most important for today. This gives us, well, it's so important that you're going to reach a point where you can't do it anymore, and your sacrifice is defiled. You can still make it right. You've got to start over. Now think about this. Let's say you hurt my feeling. I only have one. It vacillates between being hungry and being tired. Let's say you hurt that. I have more than that. Let's say you hurt my feeling, okay? Day one, I'm pretty raw, but you want to come apologize. Is that the best day? Very well could be. Okay, you know I'm forgetful, right? We've now moved a couple days down the road. You hurt my feeling. You come apologize. I'm like, what? What was that about? I may have well forgotten it. I may have been hurt, but again, I'm a forgetful guy. Okay, now we're 2 years down the road. It's bothered you for 2 years. I've moved on. 2 years ago, I'm not even sure what was going on 2 years ago. If I'd have a note, a calendar, it told me I was somewhere, I may not know. But it's bothered you for 2 years. Now you're trying to approach a God who doesn't have my failing memory. He's part of the equation. When there's a problem between you and me, it's not just you and me alone, right? Our holy God wants to be part of that relationship too. And I may be weak and forget things, and you may be weak and forget things, but the sooner we can develop a heart that prioritizes genuine atonement to maintain or sustain genuine holiness, how quicker do we become closer to one another? How do we get knit together better, quicker? Well, the quicker we get those relationships to the point where when we fail one another, we actually fail toward each other. We lean on each other. Tim? And you'll notice two implications. One, you don't do it, you're cut off from Israel. You don't maintain this kind of relationship to be in full fellowship as the covenant stipulates, then you're cut off. So on the spiritual plane, even if no one else can see the brokenness in the relationship, it's still there. And God's aware of it. And if it's a public thing, everybody's aware of it. Verses 11 and 12. Dennis, I'm going to call on you because I can. That's chapter 19, verses 11 and 12. Powerful thing to think about, the peril, like the things that God decides to lump together. None of these things, for the most part, are extremely complicated aspects of holiness, right? Like, so far, we haven't had anything that required them to go to the top of Mount Nemo and throw a rock that's going to get all the way down into the pool of Siloam, right? They didn't have to do something so crazy and impossible. These are things that are within the reach of the average person without any kind of challenge. Even here, you think about dishonesty and falsehood as it connects to a holy God. It's like the big principle that's easy to catch. When Israel struggles with the nations around them, those nations often followed a false god, a made-up god. And our Bibles sometimes help us by talking about little g and big g, right? That's how we sometimes see the Bible break those out. That, you know, Israel's God, Jehovah, is all capitaled. And then the gods of the nations around them are often lowercase to help us make a distinction. How does God feel about a person who makes the false god equal to him? Based on so far what you've learned from the Old Testament and your general Bible understanding, is God cool with that? It's a jealous God, you know. That jealousy is not the teenage dating relationship kind of jealousy where it's self-centered and all about that. It's a really, I want them in the right family because I care about the bigger picture of them. But he's a jealous God. There's no doubt there in that sense. So in this context, we talked about swearing, you know, to a false god and lying. There's actually not much of a difference. But we really understand how bad it would be to swear to a false god. Do we treat lying the same way? Culturally, first? Culturally, certainly don't. You ever watch any advertisement for anything ever? A lot of advertising, even if it's good stuff, even if it's the best of its kind, is in some way selling you a timeline lie. That by getting this now, It'll get you closer to where you want to be now at a price that's far more than now. You know, but they don't tell you that. But they sell you that lie. But even interpersonally, we struggle with that at times. Do Christians struggle with lying? Look in the mirror before you answer the question. If you lie to yourself and say you do not have sin and the truth is not in you. But we all know that. Even the most integral, honest people we know still struggle with the same structural sin in life because we're surrounded by lies. And the most active individual to break us has a nickname. He's the father of lies. That's a powerful connection here to help us understand why it's so important. It's equivalent to swearing to a false god in this context. They're laid out as being equivalent ideas of holiness. But the struggle, I think, is probably equivalent to the struggle of the attraction of a false god. Well, a false god has a really soft standard. And think, why do people lie? Do they lie to make things harder on themselves? You catch a kid doing something, is the lie that they make up that, you know, what I was really doing was plotting the overthrow of a small country, Dad, and my arms stash is in the basement, and here's my C4. No, they don't make it harder. You know, the lie is, I didn't have my hand in the cookie jar. The hand's like literally right there. It's not there. Don't believe what you see. That's what we do as adults, too. Our lies are essentially no different. I wasn't doing that. I didn't say that. I didn't think that about you. I didn't imply that. Try to soften the landing. Soften those edges. And God says, now remind yourself, a holy God. You even think further into the way in which God dealt with lying in the first century. The lie was, while it was still your own, because you do whatever you want with it. Yeah, they could have done with their land. Everyone remembers the story, right? You could have done whatever you wanted with it. Their problem wasn't that they wanted to keep some for themselves. Totally cool. Their problem was they wanted everyone to think they were more than they were willing to be. Is that a problem that we have in our culture? If you want to figure out what it is, go look at the debt load of the average American. How much indebtedness they have. That usually tells you a whole lot of that struggle. People trying to be more than they actually are. They can pull it off for a while, but eventually the bill comes due. And it's just how things like that play out. So again, we see that powerful illustration there. And furthermore, it's even tied together to the aspect of theft. The dishonesty and the taking of another person's produce. I've listened to folks just talk about, well, they don't need that before. You know, why'd you take that? Well, they don't need it. It always has a blinder to a certain degree of understanding what it took to gain the thing they took. Yeah, they may have inherited it. They may have gotten their riches like many of the kings because their father was the king. But generally speaking, folks aren't kings. They're not even kings of their own castles. They often owe money on the castle itself. Like they're kings of like 10% of their castle, maybe 15%. When in reality, whatever the thing was that they've decided to take rather than to earn represents the work someone did to earn it. And they steal that person's time. But they do so at the expense, like when you lie, like when you swear to a false god, of a sliver of who they are. You kind of cut a portion of your integrity off with each of those choices. In this context, you're slivering off a portion of your holiness and the stability that comes from being holy before a holy God. I remember having a conversation with an older evangelist years ago about a difficult conversation that was going to take place. A really challenging emotional and moral dilemma that a person was going through. And one of the things he told me is, do not underestimate the value of simply being honest in a conversation. Honest about yourself, honest about what the challenge is, and honest about your compassion for them. You're going to get far more accomplished when everything's on the table, even if you've made mistakes in that process, than you will in any other way. You'll simply accomplish far more good than you could otherwise. Next chunk is about a chunk of verses, it's 13 through 18 or so. We are going to spend more time on it on Wednesday for sure. Wednesday, I think, yes. We have two Wednesdays left in the month? Yeah, definitely Wednesday. But the broad premise attaches to an idea we already looked about, that gleaning from the field and leaving a little extra. How about oppressing your neighbors? You ever had a bad neighbor? If you've been in college, you probably had a bad roommate and a bad dormmate. But in life, you have bad neighbors too, right? Bad coworkers. They work on the line with you, and you're trying to be a holy person, and they're putting parts together, and their life is filth, and the foul language drops out of their mouth all the time, and you've got the focus trying to be holy. And we've all been in those places before. I've worked in various positions before I started preaching where I was pretty much the only Christian there. You work security at some places, and you're the big guy. Everybody else is really messed up around you. So you think about that aspect of how you interact with your neighbors. Eventually, we move into positions of some level of authority in life. It may not be a big fiefdom that we have, but with maturity and experience and excellence that comes out of the character of a Christian, often we rise. The Israelite rose too. Some of them rose at different rates in their own families. And the beginning part of this reminder is to not take that position as an opportunity to use your boot to push somebody down. You ever been on the bottom of the boot? I've been on the bottom of the boot. You ever had the boot on your foot and realized you stepped on someone and you didn't really know that you were doing it? How about this harder one? You ever did it, knew you were doing it, and then recognized what you did? Yeah. All those things are on the table for us, and God is trying to help us understand that's not how a holy person moves. A holy person who's trying to be like God will still be the firm rock that people need around them, but rather than stepping on them, they're going to be like, okay, hold on right here. I got you. God's blessed me, so I can help you. We'll get to more of that next class on Wednesday night. And so we'll hopefully finish chapter 19 at that point as we move forward to the text of Leviticus. Thanks, everybody.